next day. This was the old abandoned cemetery on Sand Hill Road, surrounded by a crumbling stone wall where, at the rear, if you approached it from the rear, there was a niche the gun could be shoved into beneath the wall. Patrick said, "You'll be going to church with Mom? You won't be able to get away until later, but pick up the gun as soon as you can. If there's any change of plans, I'll try to call you. But it should be all over by then." How lightly it sounded on Patrick's tongue. But what did it mean, exactly? Judd was going to ask Patrick about the knife. Had he brought the knife? But he couldn't summon up the words. And at that moment, Patrick leaned over to shake Judd's hand. His handshake was strong, frank, unhesitating, but his fingers were cold. Judd smiled, taken by surprise. It was the first time either of his brothers had ever shaken hands with him. They said goodbye, turned their vehicles around to drive in opposite directions. Judd back to Eagleton Corners, Patrick to the far end of Stone Creek Road. Judd waved out the window at his rapidly departing brother. He wondered what Patrick would do between now and dark, between now and it. He told himself, it was a test. It is, and almost over. Chance follows design. He wanted to believe that. It did seem to be so after his many weeks of fevered planning. Sitting now at 11 that night, moonbright Saturday eve of Easter Sunday, in his Jeep at the rear of the crowded parking lot of Cobb's Corner Inn, where Zachary Lunt and three of his high school buddies had been for the past 40 minutes. The Jeep's motor was off, no headlights. Beside Patrick on the passenger seat, hidden by a strip of canvas should anyone pass close enough to glance inside, but no one did, nor would. Patrick had parked just far enough away from other vehicles, partly on the grass, were Mike's .22 caliber Winchester rifle, several yards of rope, a roll of black duct tape, a powerful flashlight, and a fishing knife with a double-edged 8-inch blade acquired at a Sears in Whitney Point, New York, weeks before. Except for the rifle, all were anonymous items, randomly and anonymously purchased. You would not really use that, would you, PJ? The knife or the gun? You would not be so cruel or so desperate. Patrick knew that Zachary Lunt was at Cobb's. An hour before, he'd telephoned the Lunts to learn the whereabouts of his friend Zach. Don Maitland, just home from Owego, or was it Oswego, eager to join his friends for the evening. And Mrs. Lunt, who'd answered the phone in a girlish voice, had seemed to remember him, or maybe hadn't. In any case, provided the information Patrick needed. Later, maybe the rest of her life she'd regretted, but who could have known at the time? We never suspected. How would we have suspected? Mrs. Lunt had told him Cobb's Corner at 10. Asked if he knew where that was, and Patrick said, "Know where Cobb's Corner is? Hell, Mrs. Lunt, everybody knows that." Patrick stood, not quite at the bar, not a customer, but just someone who'd strolled in looking for a friend. His wool cap pulled down low on his forehead, wearing now his daytime glasses, and the collar of the army jacket turned sharply up. In the beard that felt like thistles on his face, in his steely blank expression, he believed himself disguised. In fact, there was no one who looked at him for more than a glancing moment, not even one of the bartenders. There was no one in the tavern, so far as Patrick could determine, whom he knew, except in a booth against the farther wall, Zachary Lunt and his friends. They were drinking beer, laughing together, smoking. It was the first time Patrick had seen Zachary Lunt since high school graduation, the day when, unable to avoid passing close by his sister's rapist, he'd fixed his gaze on Zachary's forehead, his face taut and expressionless as now. If the other boy had blushed or stared defiantly at him in turn, Patrick hadn't noticed. So frequently had Patrick imagined Zachary since October, since his obsession had overcome him, he had to force himself to realize, no, he hadn't seen Zachary, not in person, since June 1976. And Zachary did look slightly altered. Hair differently styled, face thicker at the jaws. Still, there was the sly, foxy narrowness at the eyes, the heavy-lidded eyes. Girls had found him attractive, and Patrick supposed he could see why. Except how broken-backed Zachary appeared, leaning his elbows on the sticky tabletop, laughing his hyena laugh with the others. He was smoking a cigarette, expelling smoke from his grinning mouth. Patrick remembered, Hadn't he smashed his fist against those teeth once? Hadn't he drawn blood? Maybe not. Maybe it hadn't happened yet. He felt a thrill of excitement in the pit of his belly, in his groin. It was a sensation Patrick Mulvaney had never had before, except possibly in his dreams. Zachary Lunt, now a student at sunny Binghamton, studying business administration. Out drinking with his old high school pals, Ike Rodman, Bud Farley, Phil Spohr. Pizza crust lay scattered on the table before them, beer cans, glasses, crumpled napkins. They all deserved punishment, not just Zachary. He'd wait for them in his Jeep, and when they left Cobb's, one by one, he'd pick them off with the rifle. Execution of justice, calm, methodical, irrevocable. Was Patrick Mulvaney capable of such an act? A forced move, one time only. You wouldn't know, would you, until you tried. Sometime, maybe. And the father, too, Morton Lunt. Even the mother, Mrs. Lunt. They, too, were involved. They, too, were guilty. Defending the rapist, slandering the victim. Patrick backed off from the bar unseen. Left Cobb's, returned to the Jeep to wait. Thinking how unsuspecting they all were, his enemies. They had no reason to be otherwise. He himself could not have said why now, why such passion on his part now, after such a long time. The Mulvaney men had long shirked their responsibility. That was it. And it was unsaid. Mike Jr. had fled all the way to the Marines, where he boasted he was a new man now, soon to be shipped to the Mideast. Michael Sr. had fled, God knows where. But there was Patrick. He was not the Mulvaney man you'd have expected to exact revenge, but there was no other, and no choice. At 12:10 a.m., at last, Zachary and his friends appeared, leaving Cobb's by the side door. Beneath the lights of a concrete walkway bordered by crude stucco latticework, the young men stood talking and laughing before going to their cars. Patrick might have picked them off one by one. How unsuspecting they were, unknowing, oblivious of danger. Patrick thought of the fantastic wingless birds of New Zealand that had intrigued the young Charles Darwin. No mammal predators for millennia. A heaven of birds, of countless species. As if all of creation were exclusively birds, yet birds not birds. Unable to fly, helpless against predators when predators arrived. Easy prey. Zachary crossed the lot to his car, a Corvette. He walked carefully, as if resisting the impulse to sway. He'd been drinking beer for hours. He was drunk. His friends pulled out of the lot while Zachary stood fumbling in his pocket, searching for his keys. No, it was a pair of glasses he took out and put on after his friends were gone. So, Zachary needed glasses to drive. So his vision wasn't perfect. Patrick started the Jeep, waited until Zachary's Corvette pulled out of the lot and followed him. A left turn, a quarter mile and a right turn, headed for Zachary's house in North Mount Ephraim near the country club. Zachary drove cautiously, not very steadily, weaving in his lane. He seemed unaware that only his parking lights were on, not his headlights. Patrick waited for the strategic moment. As Zachary turned onto Depot Street, through a darkened stretch of overgrown vacant lots, boarded up warehouses, before overtaking him, passing him on the left and blocking his way. The Corvette came to an abrupt halt. Patrick leapt from the Jeep, rifle raised to his shoulder, and aimed at Zachary's head. Don't move! Stay where you are! As if, taken so utterly by surprise, mouth gaping in cartoon astonishment, Zachary Lunt could have behaved otherwise. Quickly, Patrick came around to the passenger's door of the Corvette and climbed inside, keeping the rifle trained on Zachary Lunt's face. In mere seconds, that face had drained of blood. Zachary appeared paralyzed. His staring eyes, the slack of his mouth, his very posture that seemed to have caved in upon itself. He was in a state of panic, totally disoriented. Don't shoot, please, don't shoot, he begged. Oh, please, don't shoot, you can have my wallet, my car, anything you want, please, don't shoot. His voice cracked, there was no volume to it. He'd begun to tremble convulsively, so Patrick felt the tremors of his body as if they were his own. Is this all there is to him? The thought pierced Patrick like a knife blade. After so long, years, this is all? It was not a thought Patrick could retain. He had his plan, his strategy. He would not be deterred. Patrick said, "Drive up ahead. See that underpass? On this side of it, turn in, drive the car up that lane. Go ahead. Go." For a dazed moment, Zachary sat unmoving. Patrick was losing his patience. He tried to speak reasonably. "Come on, drive. You won't be hurt if you do as I say." Patrick's voice was deep, guttural, a voice to match the beard, the wool cap, the army jacket. "Come on, for Christ's sake, move." Zachary whispered, blinking rapidly. "Please don't hurt me. Don't shoot me. You can have my money, my car. Please, I won't tell the police. I won't tell anyone. I promise." There was a sharp smell of urine. Zachary had soiled himself. "Drive where I told you," Patrick said. "Don't be such a coward." Like a disgusted elder brother, Patrick prodded Zachary with a rifle barrel. In his endlessly rehearsed scenarios of this event, he would never have pleaded with his enemy, would never have touched his enemy with a gun. The Zachary Lunt of his imagination, wily and quick as a fox, would have seized the barrel and wrenched the gun out of Patrick's grip and shot him point blank in the face. But this was a different Zachary Lunt entirely. He didn't seem to recognize Patrick. His eyes brimmed with tears behind his glasses. He seemed incapable of focusing upon Patrick's face. "I said, don't be such a coward. Let me go. Please, don't. Drive up to that lane and turn in now." Zachary fumbled at the transmission, the steering wheel, as if he'd forgotten how to drive. He was sobbing to himself, his breath in shuddering gasps. But he did manage to follow Patrick's orders. He drove the Corvette haltingly forward to a lane that led off Depot Street into a desolate back lot of junked cars and other debris. The moonlight was vivid. The dump looked like an impromptu gathering of fantastical creatures. Hulks of rusted vehicles, part-burned mattresses, gutted sofas and chairs and broken lamps, refrigerators toppled onto their sides with doors gaping open like mouths. Beyond the dump was a railroad embankment. A quarter mile away, the dimly illuminated water tower, Mount Ephraim, in ghostly white letters. More vivid were scrawls emblazoned by teenagers, "Class of 78 in bold day-glow orange. Patrick wondered if anyone from the class of 76, reckless enough to climb the tower, had left a boastful memento behind. Before tonight, he might have credited Zachary Lunt and his friends with such exploits. Patrick's initial plan for executing justice against his enemy was to execute it here. Whatever he'd do to Zachary, he would do here. Later, he changed his mind. He had a new idea, incompletely formed. But this spot, hidden from the street in a sparsely inhabited part of Mount Ephraim, was ideal for leaving Zachary's car without driving it far. With luck, the Corvette wouldn't be discovered for a day or two, and then only because a search would be out for its owner. It was as if Patrick had spoken aloud. Zachary pleaded, "Don't hurt me, please. You can have anything you want. I promise I won't tell anyone." "Oh, for God's sake, shut up!" Patrick was both disgusted and embarrassed, his nostrils pinching at the smell of urine, human piss so much more vile, he'd always thought, than horse piss. "Turn off the motor," Patrick said. Zachary obeyed, and Patrick took the keys from the ignition and pocketed them. He would toss them away somewhere later. Unless he returned to get Zachary's car and drive it to some desolate spot, maybe into a lake or a river. This was one of his contingency plans. "All right, get out," Patrick said. Keeping Zachary at gunpoint, soldier-like in resolve, he marched him back to the street. In the shadows, in the rutted lane, Zachary kept stumbling, whimpering. He seemed to have shrunken in upon himself, inches shorter than Patrick remembered, shoulders bent and his head at a craven angle. He walked like a man whose legs are about to buckle beneath him, like an invertebrate prized from its shell, naked, vulnerable, twisting into a coil for protection against the touch of the dissecting knife. Was it possible, Patrick wondered? He himself would collapse so quickly, so ignominiously, confronted by a stranger with a gun? Is none of us any stronger, despite the heroics of TV, movies? Patrick didn't want to think so. He didn't want to think that his enemy, Zachary Lunt, whom he'd so long despised and in a way feared, was no more than this trembling, whimpering boy who'd wet his jeans. Still, Zachary was begging, "Don't hurt me, please!" Patrick shut him up by prodding him between the shoulder blades with the rifle barrel. They were in the street, which was deserted. No light except moonlight, and that light interrupted as filmy clouds were blown across the moon's bright face. At an intersection not far away, a lone car stopped for a red light. Patrick half hoped the car would turn this way. Quickly, he'd discover how he would handle the emergency situation, hiding the rifle by holding it lengthwise against his body, commanding Zachary Lunt to behave as if nothing were wrong. Would Zachary have the courage to run for help? It might be his only chance to escape. Yet Patrick guessed Zachary wouldn't have the courage. Helplessly, he'd watch the car pass, meek in the face of another's power over him. But the car continued through the intersection. The street remained empty. At the Jeep, Patrick ordered Zachary to get into the driver's seat. He was driving. "Ever handled one of these before? You'll learn." Zachary stared at Patrick, cowering. "Well, where are we going? What do you want with me?" His face was oily with sweat, and his glasses were crooked on his face. Though he stared at Patrick, it did not seem that he recognized him. Terror had blinded him. "Please, let me go. Don't hurt me. My parents are waiting at home for me. They'll give you anything you want. They'll pay you anything you want. Oh, please, sir, please." Patrick said contemptuously, "I've got other plans for you, rapist." How many times, countless times since October, he'd heard the voices, his and his enemies, "Say it, I'm a rapist. I'm a rapist. Say it, I deserve to be punished. I deserve to be punished. Say it, I deserve death." And here Zachary Lunt would stare at him speechless, in knowledge of what was to come, his just punishment. Beyond that, however, the vision was unclear. Patrick wasn't sure where it might lead. The knife? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth? But possibly just his fists. He'd never used his fists against any person. A few times in exasperation, shoving it at his older brother Mike, who'd shoved him, much harder, back, but never his fists. Not Patrick Mulvaney. Yet he might. He would. How badly he wanted to. Strike his enemy, smash his enemy's mouth. Malicious, grinning mouth he'd seen in the corner of his eye. How many times in the corridors of the high school, on the stairs, in the locker room, Zach Lunt and his friends, yes, and other guys too, hinting of Button daringly in Patrick's presence, punching one another's biceps in glee, bursting into ribald, jeering laughter. Almost out of earshot, the coarse voices, "Look, she asked for it, drunk out of her mind and all over Zach, begging for it. Got what she deserves. She was drunk, trying now to blame Zach, but we were there, we saw." Unless Patrick imagined them, in his pride bearing himself tall, impervious to the presence of such others, inferior in every way to a Mulvaney. But he had not imagined the ugly drawings and block letters, M.M., Marianne Mulvaney, sucks cock. He had not imagined these, or his deep, abiding shame, valedictorian of the class of 1976, scholarship to Cornell, state science prize. "Aren't we hot shit?" his classmates murmured of him, laughing behind their hands. "Mulvaney, Mulvaney, look, he's a Mulvaney." In a rage, in his dream, he'd begin to beat Zachary Lunt. As Zachary fell to the floor, he'd kick him with his booted feet. Heard the crack of bone, the cartilage of the nose, saw the bright blood. But immediately the vision began to fade. As soon as he touched his enemy, the vision began to fade. Like a dream of whatever ferocious intensity, dissipating upon waking, dissolving even as the dreamer tries to retain it, with what yearning, what hunger. On the way into the country, north on Route 58, and following the Yeovil River, as terrified Zachary Lunt drove the Jeep unsteadily, between 30 and 35 miles an hour, Patrick thought of such things. Executing justice, at last. "He deserves all I can give him." Patrick had to force himself. His rage at Zachary Lunt seemed to have faded. Almost he felt sorry for Zachary. How beaten, how defeated. Crotch of his jeans dark with piss. The smell of it. His backbone curved, teeth chattering. "He's already been punished, exposed," a voice advised Patrick. But this was not Patrick's plan. He would not, he vowed he would not be deterred from his plan. Signs flashed by in the darkness, illuminated by the Jeep's bright headlights. Slow curve, 35 miles per hour. Steep grade, trucks use lower gear. Uville, 65 miles. They were about 10 miles north of Mount Ephraim. To the right, the Uville River was dark, near invisible, behind dense banks of trees. This was not an area Patrick Mulvaney knew well, yet unhesitating he'd instructed Zachary Lund to drive north on Route 58. Chance follows design. Yet how much more readily than Patrick had imagined? Those many weeks of running in Ithaca, an air so cold it pained his lungs, as if preparing himself for an extraordinary test of strength, he'd believed his enemy would be cunning, dangerous, a match for him. He could not have guessed that the abduction would be so easy. Zachary Lunt, who'd had such power over him and over Marianne, ruining the happiness of their lives, so unresisting. It was as if Patrick had strode up to a door and knocked on it hard, and the door swung open. Both the Jeep's front windows were rolled down. Chill, fresh air rushed in to dissipate Zachary Lunt's stink. Panic stink, not just urine, but sweat. Oily beads of sweat rolled down his narrow face, yet Zachary seemed to be trembling less now. He'd entered a secondary state of terror, a suspension of logic. In childlike obedience to his captor, he sat gripping the steering wheel tight, his hands near the top of the wheel, leaning far forward and squinting out the windshield in a pose of utter, unswerving concentration. Without hesitation, he'd followed each of Patrick's commands, driving them out of Mount Ephraim and into the countryside. Patrick was sitting with his back against the passenger's locked door, the rifle in his lap aimed at Zachary Lunt's head. The dead white face, beaky nose, slightly receding chin. "He thinks if he obeys me, he won't be hurt," Patrick thought. The thought revolted him, as if it were an acknowledgement of his own weakness. Patrick said, "Up there, that gravel road, see? Turn off." Zachary did as he was told, braked the Jeep carefully, slowed and put on the turn signal, turning off the highway onto a badly puddled gravel road, hardly wider than a cow path leading into the wilderness. Where did he think he was being taken? What could he envision for himself that would not be disastrous in such desolation, alone with an armed man? Yet he did as Patrick instructed, murmuring what sounded like, "Yes, yes, sir." Like an animal hypnotized by its predator, a rodent about to be swallowed by a boa constrictor, putting up no resistance to its fate, as if the throbbing, protoplasmic life of the prey had already been assimilated by the life of the predator, in allegiance with its terrible hunger. Patrick thought, "I won't weaken. I won't be deterred." The bog, the dying trees denuded of leaves, peeling bark, the color of damp newsprint, smell of rot, sewage. It was only mid-April, and so the teeming, thrumming life of the bog had not yet begun. Yet there was an atmosphere of density, crowdedness, as if invisible, ravenous shapes, all mouth and gullet, hovered near. How quickly a body would decompose here, Patrick thought. It was the first he'd had this thought. "Do you know where this is?" Patrick asked, almost casually. He didn't want his deep, guttural voice to weaken with excitement. He didn't want to sound like a college kid, a boy Zachary Lund's age. "Do you know who I am?" But Zachary seemed not to hear. All his concentration went into driving, wincing as the Jeep, even with its shock-absorber tires, lurched and bucked. "I know who you are, Zachary Lunt. That's why you're here." The Jeep continued, slower and slower, until the gravel road became a spit of muddy land between stretches of bog, and Patrick said, poking Zachary's shoulder with the rifle barrel as if to wake him, "Shut off the motor. We're here." Zachary did so. Patrick pocketed the keys. It was very quiet now that the Jeep's motor was turned off, and in that quiet, Zachary had begun to cry again, softly. The Jeep's headlights were still on, illuminating a cattail-choked marsh that stretched into darkness, punctuated by slivers of light reflected in water. Patrick climbed out of the Jeep and switched on the flashlight. "Get out! Don't look back, Lunt. Just walk." Zachary climbed down uncertainly from the Jeep. He was sobbing, wiping his face on his sleeve. He whispered, "No, please, don't make me... Walk! If you can get to the other side, you can live." Was there another side? The headlights, Patrick's flashlight, the mottled light of the moon seemed to illuminate the same expanse of bog, replicated out of sight.
Why? Why are you doing this to me? I don't know you.
You know me, sure you do.
I don't, please.
Rapist. Raped my sister. Now you know.
Your sister? Who?
Now you know.
I never raped. Who?
There've been so many, is that it? So many girls?
No!
Patrick began shouting, "Just walk, Lunt, you son of a bitch! You filthy bastard ruining people's lives, a coward like you! Filth like you! You don't deserve to live, you're filth, and you belong in filth! Get going," I said. Patrick jabbed Zachary between the shoulder blades with the gun barrel, forcing him forward into the bog where he stumbled, whimpering as if desperate now to escape. Up to his ankles in the soft black muck, then to his knees. It was cold. His breath steamed. Patrick shouted at him, cursed. "You bastard, keep going! Don't look back or I'll blow your head off!" He watched as, about 15 feet out, lunging forward, Zachary fell, trying then like a frenzied animal to crawl forward through thistles, reeds, cattails. Patrick heard bubbles softly popping. The black muck stirred to life, sucking at Zachary. Was it possible? As in his nightmare? The bog was quicksand? Zachary's terrified voice was barely audible.
"Help! Help me!"
Patrick cried, raising the gun. "Help yourself, you son of a bitch! Rapist!" Elsewhere, the bog was still, silent. A faint wind through the trees, what remained of the trees, bearing an odor of rot. Beginning to slant in the sky, the bright moon, mad glaring moon, past which strips of filmy cloud were blown. Patrick thought, "He knows who I am, sure." Patrick thought, "I have executed justice." Patrick thought, "What an awful way to die." In that instant, changing his mind, as if a key had turned in a lock, abandoning his plan, though not immediately understanding that this was so. He'd sunk to his knees, squatting in the muddy soil, aware suddenly of his breath steaming, hands pressed against his ears so he wouldn't have to hear his enemy pleading for his life. "Let him die, let him suffocate in filth, it's what he deserves, rapist, murderer." Shutting his eyes tight, rocking on his heels as if mourning his own impotence, his failure for the object of his hatred wasn't the young man sinking in the bog, but the high school boy of years before, smirking, conscienceless, a coward unknown to himself, unexposed and arrogant. And that object, that enemy Patrick could not reach. Rocking in anguish on his heels, as once, a child of 2 or 3, he'd seen his own father in what unimaginable extremity of emotion, what unarticulated anguish, having to put down a young filly who'd shattered both forelegs in a freak accident. This memory was so old, retrieved from so great a distance, a fossil record of Patrick's soul. Patrick was astonished. Had he forgotten so much, even as he prided himself above all the Mulvaneys on his extraordinary powers of mind? He thought, "I love my father. How can I hate him?" It came upon him in a flash. He didn't want anyone to die, not even his enemy. He pushed through undergrowth, spiky reeds, and cattails, approaching the struggling figure from higher ground. How like a giant slug, a mud creature, feebly flailing, its head and face mired in mud. Patrick snatched up a fallen tree limb about 4 feet in length and held it out to Zachary. "Hey, Lunt! Take hold, I'll pull you out." Zachary was so exhausted or dazed, he didn't respond at once, until Patrick continued to shout at him, lifting then his head with an effort. His pale face, mottled with mud, seemed on the verge of dissolution like tissue in water. His glasses were gone and his eyes, rapidly blinking, looked both enormous and blind. He lifted his right arm with great effort, straining to close his fingers around the tree limb, but he was inches short. Patrick said, disgusted, "Grab hold for Christ's sake, goddamn you!" But Zachary couldn't grab hold. His fingers flailed helplessly, so Patrick had no choice but to step out into the bog. His feet immediately sinking in the soft bottom. He was wearing boots, but only to his ankles, and the mud came to mid-calf, loathsome, cold muck seeping into his boots. He muttered, "God damn you! God damn fucker! God damn!" leaning out as far as he dared, knowing the soft shelf of land would drop away sharply. He held the limb out trembling to Zachary, who again tried to reach it, too weak to lift his arm for more than a few seconds at a time. Zachary was sobbing, moaning. Patrick inched farther out. His face was contorted in rage, self-disgust. He could not believe he was doing this. He, Patrick Mulvaney, rescuing Zachary Lunt, after all he'd vowed, his proud plan of executing justice. It was then that Patrick lost his footing and fell heavily into the bog, averting his face just in time to avoid a mouthful of mud. Unspeakable, hideous filth, black muck. He gagged, he spat. By sheer strength, managing to lift himself, pushing out the limb to Zachary, who at last managed to close his fingers around it, weakly, then with more strength, the strength of desperation trying to pull himself to solid ground. Patrick tugged at the limb, at Zachary, the dead weight of Zachary, imagining himself sinking too into the bog, as in his nightmare, as he deserved. Betraying his own pledge, Patrick cursed steadily, words he wouldn't have known he knew, rolling off his tongue as if he'd been uttering them all his life, until after what seemed like a very long time, but must have been less than 10 minutes, he was able to haul Zachary close enough to seize his hand, his arm, his shoulder, and help him to firmer ground. "There, you bastard!" Zachary lay senseless, choking and gagging, bringing up an acid-smelling liquid from his guts. Patrick crawled from him, got shakily to his feet. Where were his glasses? He wiped muck from his face, out of his eyes, eyelashes. He wiped muck from his hands onto grass. A loathsome smell covered him like a film. He was shivering in the cold, his teeth chattering. Furious, as if a malicious trick had been played on him. "Lunch, you fucker! You don't deserve to live, but here you are." Patrick groped about the ground for his glasses, couldn't find them, then found them. Thank God they weren't broken. He lifted them quickly to his face and fitted the earpieces in place, pushing the glasses against the bridge of his nose. Now he could see again. Now he'd be all right. "I let you live, fucker. I could have let you die, and I let you live. Remember that." Zachary lay motionless on the ground, breathing in shuddering gasps. He squinted up at Patrick with that look of being blind, helpless. Don't leave me here, please. Patrick cursed and tossed Zachary's car keys at him. He located the rifle where he'd dropped it, and the flashlight, and climbed back into the Jeep, jammed the key in the ignition, and started the motor. He was boiling over with fury, stinking of muck, and in no mood to humor Zachary Lunt any longer. Let the rapist find his own way back to Mount Ephraim. Hitch a ride in the morning out on Route 58. Let the rapist invent a story to explain what had happened to him, what had so fantastically happened to him, a college boy who'd met with high school buddies for a few beers at Cobb's Corner, and next morning was discovered exhausted and dazed and covered in stinking black muck, staggering along Route 58 10 miles from his car, left parked in a dump off Depot Street, Mount Ephraim. Or let the rapist tell the truth, if such a coward dared tell the truth. Quickly, before pity weakened him further, Patrick backed the Jeep out of the bog and escaped. The prospect of actually returning and helping Zachary into the Jeep and bringing him back to Depot Street to his car, no! He would not! The experiment hadn't gone as he'd planned, but it was over, outside him now. He was feeling good, suddenly. He was feeling elated. How simple it had been, after all. How easy once he'd begun. He'd known what to do, and he had done it, and it was done now and could not be revoked. "I could have let you die, and I let you live." He and his enemy Zachary Lunt would remember those words all their lives. This is a hard reckoning for a son to make. I'm not sure how to begin, how Judd, too, went away, left my mom when she needed me, thinking I want my own life. I'm not just Mulvaney, I'm Judd. How I struck my dad and was struck by him, struck down on my ass on the ground is frankly how you'd put it. This was in Marcina, in the new place we came to live. That long, wet spring, 1980. I was 17, just transferred to the Marcina High School for the remainder of my junior year. New kid, with no friends and wanting none. Slouch-shouldered, scowling, a habit of shaking my head like a horse harassed by flies. If I smiled, which wasn't often, it was a quick, come-and-gone twitch of the lips. Mom joked, sighing, "Judd, hon, you're becoming, well, some kind of upright tick." Looking at me, the youngest of the Mulvaneys, all that remained of her children and home, as if looking into a mirror. Trying to sell High Point Farm, when real estate in the Chautauqua Valley was what the realtors called a buyer's market, and mortgage interest rates were high, that was bad luck. And Dad with debts to pay. Taking out loans, loans to repay loans, not always telling Mom what he was doing exactly, and maybe not always knowing himself. Trying to negotiate a partnership with a roofer cider in Uville that finally fell through, and another with a businessman in Marcina that dragged on for weeks and finally fell through too. Bad luck. "It's like somebody or something is fixing the dice against me," Dad said, with his shrugging smile meant to indicate he wasn't much surprised, only just a little curious. He'd always been, in the old days, a man of good luck. Eventually, though, in February 1980, after we'd about given up hope, a potential buyer made an offer that Mom dared bring to Dad. Only $2,000 below the list price. Dad shrugged and said, "Sure. How soon?" So, High Point Farm was sold. So, in March 1980, strangers came to live in the house in which Mulvaneys had lived since 1955, supplanting Mulvaneys as if we'd never been. After so many months of delay and frustration, the sale was disconcertingly swift, the closing within 15 days. A cardiologist and his perfectionist wife didn't require a mortgage but bought the property outright, and this before they'd even sold their own house and 5-acre lot in Hillside Estates. The day we moved into our new home in Marcina, Mom said, smiling, "There, thank God that's behind us." She made a dismissive gesture in the vague direction of whatever it was we'd left. The new house was only temporary, of course, a tacky split-level ranch with glary white aluminum siding like corrugated metal, simulated redwood trim, picture window, carport on a 2/3-acre lot. The cement block basement showed peculiarly like bared gums in a giant mouth. Only a few scrawny bushes grew around the house, and there could not have been more than 5 spindly trees on the entire property. We were just outside the Marcina town limits, on a country highway where trucks traveled at 60 miles an hour, sometimes more, rattling everything not cemented in place, though the speed limit was 50, and inside the town limits, 35. There were those times when the telephone rang and she could not locate a phone amid the clutter. She rushed, she stumbled. For what if it was Michael Sr., her beloved husband of whom she thought, worried obsessively as the mother of an infant, if physically parted from the infant, thinks and worries obsessively of the infant, even when her mind appears to be fully engaged, if not obsessed, with other matters? Or what if it was news of him? During these mad dashes to the wall phone in the kitchen, she hadn't time to fall, but with fantastical grace and dexterity wrenched herself upright in mid-fall and continued running, dogs whimpering, yapping hysterically in her wake, cats scattering wide-eyed and plume-tailed, before the telephone ceased its querulous ringing, though frequently she was greeted with nothing more than a derisive dial tone in any case. "Yes? Hello? Who is it? This is..." Wondering for a blank moment what her name was before hanging up sadly, like a schoolgirl passed over by friends. "This is Corinne Mulvaney. Please don't forget me." These past few months, Corinne seemed to have lost contact with Marianne. She had an address for Marianne in Erie, Pennsylvania, unless in the confusion of the move she'd misplaced it. She had no telephone number. She knew, of course, that Marianne was no longer a student at Kilburn State and no longer a resident of the Green Island Co-op, or whatever it was called. Probably Marianne had transferred to another college. Was there a college in Erie, Pennsylvania? She'd asked Judd to look it up in the local library. Kilburn State was not a highly regarded college, even within the New York State system, and the co-op, that character Abelov, simply wasn't trustworthy. So it was just as well that Marianne had left. Corinne wasn't worried. Much. hadn't time to worry about her scattered grown-up children, any more than a mother cat about her scattered grown-up kittens, telling herself it's nature's way for them to scatter, to leave the nest. As Patrick had once said, lecturing his family at mealtimes, it's the strategy by which nature assures that mammals won't interbreed with their siblings and weaken their genes. Expulsion from the Garden of Eden, with a purpose. So she wasn't truly worried about Marianne, or Patrick either. Both would contact her soon enough, she had no doubt. Rag quilt lives, both of them. Not what you'd have expected. These days, Corinne almost envied them. Then there was Mikey Jr. Of course, she didn't dare call him that now. Marine Private First Class Mike Mulvaney Jr. No mystery, at least, where he was. When people inquired, in the days when people inquired, his parents would say with pride, if uneasiness, considering the situation in Iran, that their eldest son was a Marine with a special training in electronics. They had snapshots to show of him in his dress uniform, remarkable photographs of a handsome, clean-shaven young man with a somber smile, an air of conspicuous certainty and pride. Or was it the uniform, dazzling in its beauty? When Mike had first visited home after his 11-week boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina, he'd had a difficult time adjusting to what he called the civilian world. He'd seemed uncomfortable with his own parents, pained at his father's drinking and smoking and even his posture, and eager to return to the Marines. Corinne had been so hurt, so shocked, and she'd let Mike Jr. know. This past year, thank God, Mike was coming around. Worried about the farm and what Corinne had passed on to him of his dad's business problems, she'd spared him any news of the drinking, the second arrest, the trouble with that vindictive Judge Kirkland. Mike had begun to call home more often, and even to send postcards. He'd never been one to write letters, but postcards were just right, and they were from such exotic places as Gibraltar, Cairo, Saudi Arabia. Signed with just a carefully scripted Mike, usually. Though once, on the reverse of a card depicting a brilliantly blue Mediterranean sea, he'd signed, "Thinking of you and love, Mike." Michael, who'd long behaved as if he hadn't been missing his eldest son, was much moved by these cards, especially "Thinking of you and love, Mike." So Mike Jr. was growing up, maturing. It was a miracle how the Marines had made a man out of a hot-headed, immature kid who hadn't been able to get along with anyone except his drinking buddies. If to be a man is to be in control of oneself and taking pride in the fact. Home wasn't home and wasn't very real, and that was fine with me. School was even less real, like a TV program I'd switch on, stare at for a few seconds, then switch off. Bullshit. Back from Marcina High School, I'd immediately shut out all memory of the place. Because we'd moved in midterm in March, I had less than 4 months before summer recess, and already I'd begun looking for after-school and Saturday work, freed at last from farm chores and needing and wanting more to do. Wanting to make some money of my own. Money of my own. It was like a prayer. Maybe not being a farm kid any longer wasn't 100% bad. In the old days, when I guess we had money, or anyway Mulvaney Roofing was prosperous, Dad loved to joke and tease about how much a farm like High Point cost, how much the largely useless animals cost, and his kids, and his wife's notorious expenditures. Now he was facing bankruptcy. He never spoke of money at all, let alone joked about it. "Don't worry, Dad. I'll go to work, too. I can help out. If we don't get along, I can move out, too. Just watch. Mind your own business, Judd. Make your own way. No one knows the Mulvaneys here." I'd always liked that as a little kid, and as a 17-year-old transfer from one life to another, I was liking it more and more all the time. Take care of Mom. Be sure Mom doesn't crack up. As for Dad, stay out of his way. I don't want to misrepresent my father. There were days when he didn't drink much, or in any case didn't show the effects of drinking, which were for him an anesthetized glare on the edge of belligerence, but lacking the energy to cross over. At the time, I guess I hardened my heart against him. "He's a drunk, he's a fool, he's stupid. He doesn't give a shit about you or Mom." Dad would order me to do something, and I'd shrug sullenly and take my time doing it. And Dad would give me a shove on the shoulder, oh, just a shove, to show who's boss. and my heart would flood with rage. Adrenaline rushed through my skinny kid's body, hot to bursting. I thought of the shotgun, the rifles now packed away somewhere in the basement amid the chaos of cartons, boxes, barrels. Yes, but I know where. I can find them, and it seemed to me the most natural thing, that a son might kill his father, to protect not just himself, but his mother. He's waiting to explode. Look what he did to Marianne. Erased her like she never existed. What makes you think he won't do the same fucking thing to you? I missed Patrick. My brother I loved. My brother I'd been led to think was my friend, needing to talk to him for his intelligence, his wisdom. What had he said of our parents? They were casualties. Dad was like some poor creature whose life is being sucked out of him by a predator, by nature's plan. Yet Patrick had seemed to blame Dad anyway. He'd never forgiven him. When he called home, which was rare, it was never at a time Dad was likely to be home, only Mom and me. These were the months, eventually years, my brother Patrick was out of contact with the family for long periods of time. I missed him so. Tried to harden my heart against him, too, but could not. Just when I'd thought I had a brother at last, and I was a brother at last, I'd lost Patrick. God damn him. Hurting Mom, too. Mom and Judd, two people who loved him. I guess I was the only person on Earth who might have understood why Patrick went away when he did. Sabotaging what looked to be a summa cum laude BA at Cornell. Disappointing his professors who'd had such hopes for him. But even I didn't really understand. He'd felt good about the execution of justice that he hadn't killed Zachary Lunt after all, hadn't even hurt the bastard much. Said he felt free, would never need to punish any living creature again. And if Zachary had recognized Patrick, apparently he'd never told a soul. Still, Patrick had disappeared. We'd received postcards from him from time to time, forwarded from our old address. Postmarked California, Utah, Idaho. He was working with learning disabled children in Oakland, California. Had a job in a fire watch station in Glacier Park, Montana. He was in Boulder, Colorado, taking courses at the university in geology and archaeology. He'd apprenticed himself to a Japanese woman potter. But soon, then working as a hospital orderly in Denver. Then again, a month later, in Fargo, North Dakota. Promise we'll call soon. I'm in good health and hope all is well with you. Making arrangements to return to Cornell and get the degree. Sorry for being out of contact and promise we'll call soon. Love, PJ. We waited to hear more about Patrick returning to Cornell, but a long time passed. We waited for him to call and waited. That Easter Sunday last year, I'd done exactly as Patrick instructed. After Mom and I came home from church, after a harried lunch, I drove out saying I was going to visit a friend, went to the old abandoned cemetery on the Sand Hill Road and found the rifle where Patrick had promised. I was scared as hell, scurrying like a rabbit, imagining police surveillance, somebody hiding amid the trees. But it was quiet, still. Deserted like the country usually is, especially a lost old cemetery where the carved names of the dead have flattened out to almost nothing and weeds have grown taller than the tallest headstones. In nature, Patrick said, energy is never lost, it's only reconverted. But a cemetery makes you wonder. So many people, so many lives, each one once thinking, here I am, look at me, I'm something. Yeah, right. But there was Mike's .22 Winchester rifle, neatly wrapped in the same canvas, shoved beneath some loose rock. Without letting the canvas fall back, I sniffed the gun barrel. It didn't seem to have been fired. Not fired. Patrick hadn't fired the gun. Not a murder weapon in my hands. Of course, he might still have used the knife. There was that terrible possibility. Patrick might have used the knife. For what had my brother said, boasted, he was accustomed to dissecting animals in the lab? Was that actually what Patrick had said? I carried the rifle back to High Point Farm, smuggled it into the house and back to Dad's cabinet, locked the cabinet door. I was desperate to hear from Patrick what had happened, but he didn't call until 10 p.m. that night from Ithaca, and then he said only, tersely, "It's over. Justice has been executed." But Patrick, what happened? Look,
Judd, the less you know, the less you're involved. It's over. But what does that mean? Did you actually... I don't think he'll ever tell anyone what happened, even if he recognized me, which I'm not convinced he did or didn't. You understand? Patrick was speaking rapidly. It's over, and I'm through, and I might not be speaking to you or Mom for a while. But Patrick, can't talk now, Judd, but thanks, and hey, I love you.
Quickly hanging up, before I could stammer any response.
So I think in the months and eventually years to come, Patrick loves me. What I'd risked was worth it, which I still believe to this day. It was in early June, just before the incident between Dad and me, and maybe this had something to do with the incident, that suddenly Marianne was back in touch. Calling one Sunday evening as if nothing were wrong, and we hadn't heard from her in months. "Oh my goodness, Marianne," Mom exclaimed. "I picked up the phone and, oh my goodness, it's you." Pressing her hand against her heart, leaning against a doorframe. Marianne was fine, she said. Living in Spartansburg in the very northwestern corner of Pennsylvania, south of Erie. Her address was in care of a woman named Penelope Hagstrom, a poet, a philanthropist in her 60s, a wonderful person for whom Marianne was a sort of all-around assistant and friend. Miss Hagstrom was confined to a wheelchair. She'd been stricken with multiple sclerosis at the age of 29. She'd been engaged, but the young man had broken it off and she'd never married. Had no children, and just a handful of distant, not very involved relatives. A wonderful person, Marianne reiterated, with high standards of integrity, behavior. Mom was guardedly pleased, hoped that Marianne was still managing to take some college courses, and Marianne vaguely murmured, yes, or she would be soon at a local community college. On the phone with me, Marianne was cheerful, sunny-sounding. Questions about my new school, new friends I'd made. How did I like Marcina? I managed to answer in the same tone, saying what sounded plausible. There was in the background, beyond Marianne's voice, a muted clatter like dishes being washed, cutlery. I had a quick flash of my 21-year-old sister holding the phone receiver awkwardly between her shoulder and one ear as she stooped over a sink in someone's kitchen. Elsewhere, in another part of the house, a chisel-faced, gray-haired woman sat in a wheelchair, blanket tucked in tight over her knees, waiting for Marianne to please hurry, to push her out into the garden before it gets too chill. In a lowered voice, hurried as if she was running out of time, or in fact someone was calling her, Marianne said, "Muffin's in great shape, Judd. I forgot to tell Mom, so will you? Muffin says hello, and he misses you all." "Well, hello to Muffin, too. We miss him, too." "He loves it here. It's so much more peaceful than the co-op."
"It sounds sort of busy."
There was a muffled sound in the background as of creaking, rolling. A door with hinges needing to be oiled. Unless it was a voice. "Oh, dear, I guess I have to hang up now, Judd. Love you. Miss you. Marianne, wait. Love to Daddy, too, but don't tell him if he won't want to hear, please. Bye." And in an instant, it all vanished. Dishes being washed in a sink, humming vibrating refrigerator, Miss Penelope Hagstrom in her wheelchair, Muffin picking his way through a stranger's walled garden, my sister Marianne with her head at a sharp angle holding a telephone receiver against her shoulder. Not even a dial tone, just a dead line. A few days after Marianne's call, there Mom was with a book she'd driven 70 miles to a Uville bookstore to buy, The Selected Poems of Penelope Hagstrom. The publisher was a real New York publisher, and the poems, Mom said, were difficult to understand, but very good, she thought. In fact, profound. "Oh, I'm so proud of Marianne," Mom said excitedly. "I'm thinking of calling some old friends in Mount Ephraim. Finally, my daughter has been recognized by someone of quality." Next night was the incident between Dad and me. This was the night of June 11th. A damp, windy, nothing day, by coincidence exactly a month before my 18th birthday, when Mom's rattletrap old station wagon finally broke down and died. She'd been doing errands in Marcina, and the motor just gave out. Lucky for Mom, practically in the front yard of Jimmy Ray Pluckett and his wife Nancy, the Reverend and the Reverend of the New Church of Christ the Healer of Marcina, New York. Not only did Jimmy Ray call a tow truck for Mom immediately,
But when the mechanic told Mom the bad news, that the motor was beyond repair, Jimmy Ray and Nancy drove Mom out to the house 5 miles away. Dad missed supper that evening, didn't call to explain why, arrived home around 10 p.m., sullen and heavy-footed and in no mood for surprises. He'd seen, of course, that the Buick was missing from the driveway, and naturally he wasn't happy about it. I heard him and Mom discussing the problem, calmly enough at first, and then with more urgency as Dad's voice rose in volume with a beat like chopping wood. "Don't listen. Stay out of it. He can't seriously blame her, can he?" I was in my room at a back corner of the house, a room approximately the size of the old claw-footed bathtub we'd had at the farm, and I'd pushed my windows up as far as they could go so the exterior night seemed to be in. I was sprawled on my bed, listening to a radio turned low, and leafing through some paperbacks I'd brought home, borrowed, from the Miracle Mart where I worked 4 afternoons a week. After a while, I couldn't pretend not to be hearing. My drunk, bully dad cursing my mom because he's a loser, he's a failure, and a bankrupt, and all the world's waiting to know. So I run out there, so scared I'm shaking, and it's just then that Dad must have pushed or punched Mom. There's her cry of pain, "Oh, Michael!" And she's scrambling to escape, out the side door, beneath the carport, and Dad is grabbing at her, ripping a sleeve of her shirt, tugging at her hair. "God damn, you listen to me! Just for once, you listen to me!" But Mom gets away, and Dad's right behind her, and huddled beneath the breakfast nook, Foxy and Little Boots are barking in terror. I'm running into the kitchen, and outside where my parents are struggling together, panting, Mom crying, I'm pulling at Dad's arm. "You don't touch a man like Michael Mulvaney," but I'm pulling at his fatty, muscled arm. "Don't hurt Mom! You're drunk! Leave her alone!" And Dad bares his teeth at me, a vein standing out on his forehead, a red, flushed, sweaty face like a mask, one of those Polynesian devil masks I'd seen in a book. And with one arm, as if he's slinging a box of shingles onto a truck, he swings me around, slams me against the side of the house as Mom begs, "No, no, 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 Michael, no!" There's a roaring in my ears, but I'm flailing out at Dad, striking with my fists that haven't the force to counter the force coming at me, the sheer weight of my father, 200 pounds, so compact, bull-necked. I'm as tall as Dad now, but 50 pounds lighter, and he's practically laughing at me, contemptuous, loathing. "Who do you think you are, you punk? You're nothing. You and your brothers letting your father down, insulting your father. Every one of you, ungrateful bastards!" His hard fist on the side of my head, my head's ringing. Suddenly I'm sliding down the wall of the house, sitting on the cold cement floor of the carport, amazed, touching my face that's slippery with blood. And Mom is bending over me, crying, "Oh, Judd, oh, honey, are you hurt?" And Dad backs off, disgusted. "You make me sick, both of you, you hear? You make me sick. Get a man in a trap, rat in a trap, his head in a vise, tangled in fucking barbed wire." His voice trails off, muttering. He doesn't touch Mom again, luckily, because I can't stop him if he does. He might kick, kick, kick me, and I don't have strength enough even to crawl away. Instead, he fumbles for his car keys in his pants pocket, drops them, gropes for them on the cement with a grunted obscenity, throws himself into the Lincoln and backs out skidding and seesawing to the highway with the twin manic German shepherds next door barking furiously in his wake, and behind Mom and me in the kitchen, our dogs are whimpering. Following that night, I moved out. I would live by myself in Marcina, I said. Yes, I was strong enough, I could do it. Never again under the same roof with Michael Mulvaney Sr. In fact, it seemed to me that Michael Mulvaney Sr. had died, and another man had taken his place, not even resembling him that much, and maybe that's a good thing. I had my job at Miracle Mart, and later on I'd get a better-paying job at the Milk Jug, and still later a part-time job with the Marcina Weekly Packet, whose editor was a brother of the English teacher at the high school I came to be friends with my senior year. Actual writing, reporting, my byline Judd Mulvaney there in print, and even being paid for it. Beyond that, I